This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, reminding you each time that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, men and sometimes women too, who have done remarkable things, survived against incredible odds, all for the sake of our freedom. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard about so many different aspects of World War II, but for many Americans, knowledge of that war has concentrated on a couple key dates, like December 7th, 1941, or the one we just marked the 70th anniversary of, June 6th, 1944, a huge commemoration in France, of course, ceremonies all over the world to mark what was famously and aptly dubbed the longest day. And we're going to make that the focus again today before jumping into a Navajo Code Talkers story next time. Before we get underway, I want to welcome a few new stations to our list of affiliates carrying Hometown Heroes now. KFIV Power Talk 1360 in Modesto, California. KIVA 95.9 and 1600 AM, the Rock of Talk in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And KWSX Power Talk 1280 in Stockton, California. Welcome and glad to have you on board. Hometown Heroes exists for the purpose of honoring our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserving their stories so they won't be forgotten, and along the way, of course, we learn so much history through the eyes of those who lived it. We're educated, sometimes inspired, and we certainly understand a little better the price that has been paid for our freedom. On June 6th, 1944, that price was an extremely heavy one. Add up the American, Canadian, and British troops that hit the shores of Normandy that day, and there were more than 150,000. That doesn't even count the air support, naval forces, and other elements participating in a massive operation. 2,500 Americans died on D-Day alone. And of course, the fight was not over with that longest day. There are nearly 9,400 Americans buried in Normandy cemeteries. Over the years, I've had the privilege of interviewing many veterans who were there that day, from Coast Guardsmen taking troops ashore to engineers sneaking in to set explosive charges, nurses treating the wounded, airmen bombing from up above, sailors providing artillery support for the Rangers scaling Point du Hoc, glider pilots landing behind enemy lines. And as we reflect again on D-Day this week after marking that 70th anniversary, I wanted to share with you pieces of the tales from a couple special paratroopers I met in El Paso, Texas. Airborne troops had among the toughest of jobs in Operation Overlord, and they bore a disproportionately costly burden. During the entire course of the Normandy operation, between the All-American 82nd Airborne and the Screamin' Eagles of the 101st, there were over 2,000 killed, more than 5,000 wounded, and another 1,500 paratroopers missing or captured. You talk about treacherous duty, that was it. So let's get an idea of the kind of men we had jumping behind enemy lines. We're going to hear from two men who called themselves brothers, starting with retired Lieutenant Colonel Bob Chisholm. He enlisted at 17, saw a couple paratroopers in their jumpsuits doing jujitsu, thought that looked cool, and volunteered for airborne duty. Was still just 17 when he finished jump school at Fort Benning, and nearly 30 years later would end up as one of a select few who can claim the Triple Combat Infantry Badge, because he fought in combat conditions in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. We'll work our way toward D-Day with Bob, who felt the training he received with the 82nd Airborne's 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment played a big role in his survival.
We had some of the finest officers and NCOs that the Army ever produced. In particular, one that will always be in my mind is Lieutenant Colonel Louis G. Mendez. He was our battalion commander. And I think that because of the training that we'd received from him and emphasis on the task in front of us and in preparation for it, that I'm here today. And I think you'll probably hear that again later. But in the time that we were ready to go into Normandy, I think without exception that most of the troopers in the regiment were ready to go, because that's what we've been training for. We look forward to it. I don't recall ever having any anxiety at all about it.
Too young and dumb to know any better at 18 years old?
Too young and dumb, yeah. And well trained. Well, this is what we're trained for. Such an extensive program that physically and mentally you were ready. You thought that you were the best. And as far as we were concerned, we were the best. We were the elite. This is what we've been training to do. let's go and do it.
I also imagine that every time June 6th rolls around, you reflect back on it. So I'm guessing your memory of that day is still pretty sharp. How early did that day start for you?
Well, it actually started on June the 5th. I think around 10:30 in the evening, we boarded the planes. We'd had one delay, of course, one day delay, and we boarded the planes. We took off from our airfield and circled and joined with the rest of the flights. I think the best I can remember is we were out of the plane at about 1:37.
Pitch black.
No, there was actually just clouds. There was moon out and there's clouds.
Moon and clouds, and you could probably see some other aircraft around?
Well, yes, all the aircraft in our flight. As we approached, as we passed over the Guernsey Islands, we caught some flak there. And then as we passed over the Normandy coast, we began to get flak, and we ran into the clouds. And the planes, not the ones in my particular V, but the other planes began to disperse. And consequently, when we jumped, our Pathfinders had not been able to set up their equipment. So we then jumped on the green light of the pilot where he thought we should be. And it wasn't, I didn't land on our designated DZ or landing zone. In fact, when I landed, I didn't know where I was at. I didn't recognize the terrain around me at all. And the hedgerows. And I had a little problem getting out of my chute. And I had to take my knife that I had strapped to my leg and cut myself out of my chute. Walked out to the road, and this is a thing that you're not taught not to do, is stay on the road. Anyway, I walked down the road, and the first I heard was a motorcycle coming down. I knew we didn't have any motorcycles, and so it was a German motorcycle, a sidecar, and opened fire on them, knocked them out, and kept walking, came up on a glider, looked in the glider, and everybody in the glider was dead. Walked a little while further into St. Mary Glees, and I saw John Steele hanging from the tower in St. Mary Glees. So that was the 3rd Battalion of the 05 had the objective of taking St. Mary Glees. They were there, and so I stayed with G Company of the 05 for the first 4 days until we got together more of the 508.
And folks who've seen the movie The Longest Day know John Steele. When you say you saw John Steele hanging there, he's the paratrooper whose parachute caught on the back steeple of the church. He was hanging there for 2 hours pretending to be dead. He was eventually captured by the Germans but then escaped and rejoined his division.
As you describe that, as you come down, you have problems with your chute, you have to cut yourself out. Now, I'm hearing that you were all by yourself at this point?
I was all by myself, yep.
And you're 18 years old.
I'm 18 years old.
Behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. Did it hit you? Well, how difficult the situation you were in? Or were you just running on adrenaline? I mean, what was that like to be an 18-year-old in those kind of circumstances?
The only thought that I had at that time was to get together with the other members of my unit and get the mission accomplished that we were given. I don't think that the severity of the situation really struck me until we were in the trenches dug by the Germans outside of St. Mary Glees and had an 81 mortar position sitting there. And the 81 mortar position fired off a couple of rounds. These were the 505. And they drew fire from an 88 and killed everyone in that mortar position. And that's when it struck me that, well, you can get hurt doing this. And that was the first time. It dawned on me how serious the situation was.
I want to ask you, just to go back a little bit, before you jumped out of that airplane in the dark of night on this historic day, did you take a moment to pray, to reflect, to think? Do you remember anything that might have flashed through your mind before you made that jump out of that airplane on a day that would change your life and really change the history of the world?
I don't recall that I prayed at prior to the jump. I might have in the plane. I was raised in a religious family, and I probably did. I don't recall specifically that I did. I was the number 2 man in the stick behind my platoon leader. I was his radio operator. So he was standing in the door watching our flight as we passed over the coast, and he could see some of the flak that the planes were getting. Really, the only thought was, let's get out of the plane, get it over with, get on the ground, and get going on our mission.
And I'm just imagining that every hour brought another situation you'd never faced before in your life, and you have to be pretty adaptable in those circumstances. Pick it up where you left off, and because you're still behind enemy lines, you met up with some of your fellow Americans. that are fighting the Germans there. What did you encounter next?
The 3rd Battalion of the 05 was holding a pretty strategic position there in St. Mary Glees, because this was a key road junction. And the only way the Germans could get reinforcements down toward the beach was to pass through St. Mary Glees. So the Germans attacked St. Mary Glees on several occasions, and we were involved in fighting off the attack, defending against them, which we did. So it was several days that I was with them, with the 505, we had been subjected to attacks by the German and defending position. Then I began to meet up with more of the troopers from the 508 and left the 05 and rejoined our unit.
All right, so there was still a long way to go for what you would encounter. This is the first day of the invasion that you described for us, and moving forward, you meet up with some of the guys that you knew before. And I'm sure that the stories started to come your way about guys who hadn't been as fortunate as you. Did it start to weigh on you, the losses that you knew had been suffered in that first jump on June 6th?
No, at that particular time, I wasn't aware of any losses. I had not had any conversation with anyone that said, we lost so-and-so or lost so-and-so. The actual knowledge of the losses would come on a day-to-day basis later when we actually got involved in attacking our objectives. And then you would actually see some of those that you had been friends with through the training years become casualties. And that began to impact on you. And then you begin to realize how serious this whole thing was, that this was really a pretty dangerous operation, and people were getting killed, and it could happen to you.
And how constant was it for you? Did you ever find time to get a little break, or were you always on edge? Did you never have a chance to relax a little bit in that situation?
I don't recall ever having relaxed a minute from the time that we jumped into Normandy until the time that I was wounded and evacuated through medical channels. Yeah, and you stayed on the edge all the time, and you the adrenaline was flowing, and this was very helpful to you too, because it kept you more you became more alert, and realized that this was a situation that could result in your death, and so you better stay sharp. You better remember everything that you'd been taught during your training. So that was a constant reminder of just how serious the situation was.
Well, you kind of answered my next question, which was, how did you keep from cracking up in a situation like that, from staying focused and being able to do your job? And you talk about that adrenaline and staying alert. Do you think, was there one thing, one concept, one idea that maybe had been shared with you in training, or just one aspect of your personality and the way you were equipped that you think helped you get through it?
Well, I think that the training that we had taken and been exposed to was the major factor in your mental attitude in combat. We had received the best training, I think, that any individual could probably possibly get. The mere fact that we were paratroopers and that we were expected to be able to do more than your average soldier. This had been really emphasized during all our training, that you're airborne, you're paratroopers, you're the elite, you're the best, and that's the way we expect you to be. And that's the way we were. I think initially, and then on during the entire campaign with the airborne. Now, don't misunderstand me. After that initial contact, especially seeing that the mortar crew being killed, it stayed in your mind just how serious the situation was, and then you begin to feel that fear. And that's not something that I had it to begin with. There just wasn't anything that bothered me to that point. But with each day of combat, you become a little more fearful. And the only thing that kept me going, and I'm sure that you'll hear this again, that kept the others going, I would rather have anything happen to me than to let my buddies down. That was a driving force. That pretty much predominated throughout a lot of individuals.
Just knowing that someone else was depending on you, so it's one thing to let yourself down, but if you let them down, then you're doing everybody a disservice?
That's exactly right. I would have preferred to have been killed than to have let my buddies down.
Yep, that's the kind of individual that was jumping behind enemy lines on D-Day 70 years ago. We're going to get more of Bob Chisholm's story when we come back. We'll find out what saved his life after he was wounded, and we'll also hear from another D-Day paratrooper as well. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing again on D-Day, June 6th, 1944, in the wake of the 70th anniversary of that history-altering page on the calendar. We've been hearing from Bob Chisholm, who found himself alone in the dark once he parachuted down behind enemy lines 70 years ago.
When that day gets here every year, and when you think back, you experienced it from one person's point of view, but with the lens of history, you've seen the big picture and you know how significant that day was. What's the significance to you? What are you most proud of in terms of being a part of June 6, 1944?
The thing I'm most proud of is I had survived. Mm-hmm. Not really. To have been a part of that operation, to have been a part of history, I think it has really left an impact on myself and probably most veterans that participated in D-Day.
So you mentioned, I know we're skipping past probably a lot of things to get there. Where were you wounded? What was the circumstances around that? What happened?
I was on a patrol. We were preparing to attack out of the position we were in, and I was on a combat patrol. We were to make contact with the enemy to find out where their positions were, and I was the point man on the patrol with my good friend Bill Hughes. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. It's daylight. And we walked into a German position that had a armored car and a machine gun. And I took a machine gun wound in my right shoulder and my forehead. I remember that distinctly because it was my 19th birthday, June the 23rd.
June the 23rd of 1944. Happy birthday. And you say your forehead. Now, I've talked to a lot of guys with a lot of close calls. But to me, if you were wounded in the forehead, that's a pretty stinking close call.
Actually, back of my head here. Just the bullets just broke a little bit of my skull and the skin, and then all my right shoulder. I was taken out.
Did you lose consciousness, or were you?
No, I didn't. My friend Bill Hughes kept saying, Bob, are you all right? And every time he said, Bob, are you all right? They'd open up that machine gun again. And I was just in enough of a death lay that it just clipping the top of my head still. I was thinking, I wish you'd shut up.
Shut up or we're going to get killed, huh?
He says, I'm going to open fire on them, and let's get the hell out of here. And I had a BAR. I don't know how I ended up with a BAR, for God's sakes. But I had a BAR, and when he opened fire, I jumped up and opened fire, and we both took off, and we ran into our patrol on the way back. So I was able to move pretty good still.
You had to be in a pretty good amount of pain, though, I would think.
I don't recall it so much.
So I guess it probably didn't keep you out of commission for too long then, huh?
No, I went back to the England hospital. I was gone for a couple of months. I got back just in time for the Operation Market Garden.
And you saw action there, the big airdrop at Operation Market Garden, and then also at the Battle of the Bulge, right?
The Bulge, yes.
After being wounded and surviving it, did it embolden you? Did it make you think that you were going to survive, or did it tell you, wow, that was a close call, how bad's the next one going to be?
I think your second description is more correct. Mm-hmm. That was a close call, and when's the next going to be? Mm-hmm. And I was scared before, but from that point on, I stayed scared for the rest of the time.
What were some of the other moments that you reflect on and say, wow, I should have been scared, because that easily could have been my day, the day that my number was called?
I don't know that I dwelled on that to any great extent. I just consider myself to have been very fortunate to have been wounded and survived, and I knew I was going to leave the hospital and go back to the unit, which I anticipated. In some circumstances, we're in the hospital, they would take and put you in another unit, try to put you in another unit, and I didn't have that problem. I went right directly back to the 508, who was still in Nottingham.
I can't interview a guy who was at the Battle of the Bulge without asking him how bad those conditions were, and if you had ever encountered something like that before. What was the toughest thing for you to deal with during that time?
Well, that was actually the most miserable that I can remember having been in my entire military career during the Battle of the Bulge.
And you stayed in through Korea and Vietnam, so that's a lot of years that you're talking about.
Right. We were not prepared for the cold weather, and it was really cold. We were picked up on the 18th of December, put in trucks, went right into the bulge, went right into combat, and we were poorly equipped for the weather at that time. And that was just a miserably cold weather. That's what I remember about the bulge.
So you're 19 years old. You've already been wounded. You're back on duty, and now you're freezing your rear end off. And I have to imagine you don't know if you're going to make it or not. What do you think kept you going? How did you survive through that and keep doing your job?
The thing that kept me going was the fact that this was my duty. And again, I'd like to emphasize this, never let your buddy down. And I had been wounded in Holland also.
Operation Market Garden?
Right.
Where were you wounded there?
Flak, coming out of the plane, in the face and the body.
So before you even hit the ground, you're bleeding and hurt?
Ground, right.
Did that take you off the lines at all or no?
No. I was taken into a Dutch hospital, and they put some stitches in my face and went right back to doing what I was supposed to do.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot that you could tell me, and I want to get to all these other guys too. I have to imagine that the end of the war, that VE Day had some significance for you after being wounded in the Normandy operation and Operation Market Garden, surviving the cold of the bulge, to have this all over in May of 45. How great of a feeling was that for you?
Well, I was wounded for the third time during the Battle of the Bulge, and that was my million-dollar wound. It got me back to the States in the hospital, and I was in the hospital here at William Beaumont Hospital at the time of that the war ended.
All right, so let's backtrack. Tell me the story of how you got hurt at the Bulge.
We had withdrew from our defensive position so we could even up our lines, and that was on the 5th of January, I believe, and that was at Theodore Mont Ridge. And then we had to, we then went into a counterattack, and we had to take the Theodore Mont Ridge back, and that was on the 7th of January, and artillery tree burst got me. Took out my left thigh, and it was freezing weather, and I know that our medic came and gave me a shot of morphine, left the cassette on there that showed I had the morphine, and I was out there for about 6 or 7 hours before they got me back. He had looked at some minor wounds and had not seen the wound on my leg, and I think because that froze and that kept me from bleeding, that probably saved my life.
So as miserable as the cold made you, it saved your life?
Probably so. Because it just froze, stopped the bleeding in the leg, which I guess was quite serious at the time.
So you're back here in Texas at the hospital when the war comes to an end. Did that mean something to you at the time? Had you been thinking you might go back at some point, that could be a possibility for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I was mighty glad it was over. Uh-huh. And the possibility would always existed. Yeah, we could have gone to the South Pacific, and I didn't know that some people were going to the South Pacific. I was very, very thrilled that the war was over.
A couple more questions for you. You're wounded three times in three of the major battles in the European theater. Yet, for some reason, you decided to stay in the military for Korea and Vietnam. Somebody's wounded three times, a lot of times they're going to get the hint and say, this isn't for me anymore. Why were you different? What motivated you to continue to serve our country that way?
They lost my records. I was a high point man in the regiment. You accumulated points, and then they would send you back to the States. I was high point man in the regiment and would have been sent back on rotation had it not been for the bulge. Going from a medical facility to hospital, they lost my records. And I was sitting out here in William Beaumont, and I would go home on leave, and I'd see my friends and my brother, and they were drawing their, $21 a month or whatever it was. And I had learned that the 508 was being commanded by Colonel Mendez, and they were staying in 508, that's Parachute Infantry Regiment. They were staying in Germany in the occupation, and I sent a letter over and said to Colonel Mendez, said I would like to come back and join the regiment. And he wrote a letter to the Department of the Army and said, this sergeant wants to reenlist and come back. Anyway, he arranged for it, and I reenlisted and went back to the regiment. So that's the reason I stayed in.
You felt you still had something to prove, or what?
No, didn't have a thing to prove. Just that I didn't feel like I wanted to spend the time of my buddies drawing that 21 or whatever it was that they drew for unemployment and spending my days drinking beer at the Dairy Queen.
So how many years total did you put in?
29 and a half.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I am I'm a triple CIB winner. I think I'm more proud of that.
That's combat infantry badge, for people who don't know.
Badge. It's only a little over 300 of them were awarded military-wide.
Sounds like you'd rather have that than a Distinguished Service Cross or a Medal of Honor.
No, I'm not saying that. You asked me what I was more proud of.
Yeah. Well, what does that signify to you, that you did that?
Well, it signifies to me that, as I mentioned, I'm one of less than a little over 300 that has been awarded the Triple CIB. When you consider that Army-wide, the number of people that served, in the infantry, only a few over 300 has received that award, then that's the reason I'm very proud of it.
Last question for you, unless you have more to add, feel free. But you've got a good gathering of guys right here, and just being in this facility, you get a sense for the history that's here, for the amount of sacrifice that this represents, and for the fraternity that you have with your fellow paratroopers, your fellow airborne veterans. What has that meant to you, the camaraderie here in the El Paso area of airborne veterans?
I am a member of the finest fraternity in the world, and that is airborne. You've heard Blood Brothers. These individuals are truly my brothers. And Angel Romero and I mentioned to you that we served in the same battalion, mm-hmm, in the 508 through World War II. And when we are at any kind of function, we'll say, if we're introducing ourselves to somebody, that this is my brother. And they sort of look at us funny because Angel is Hispanic and I'm not quite. That's what it means to me.
And we're going to hear from that brother now. Angel Romero passed away in October 2012, a few months after I'd had the privilege of catching up with him in his native El Paso at what they call the home of the airborne, Partida Hall, decked out in historic photographs and mementos of our airborne heroes. I started out with Mr. Romero by asking what it was like growing up there in El Paso.
Super. It was just, I was born there on Chelsea Street, and my dad owned a couple of farms, and we worked all the time. After starting school, then we found out that there was a lot of discrimination, especially high school. I found out then that it was pretty bad, very, very bad, and discrimination.
So as a Hispanic, you didn't feel you were treated the same as the white students in your high school?
Certainly not. There was a lot of discrimination at the time.
And I know it would be different for you in the military, but let me ask you about December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
At that time, I was a newsboy, and I was delivering the Sunday papers, and the area where I live, very few people had electricity or radios. But I found out there was a bunch of people there in one of the houses where they had a radio, and that's how I found out that they had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Was that a big deal to you?
Not at the time. I didn't understand what was going on. They were talking about, we had heard and we had studied in school. We had been taught about what the problems were coming. But I don't think I had ever heard about Pearl Harbor until that day.
Did it occur to you that this war might be something that you would end up involved in?
No, not at all, because at that time, being, what was it, I was 16, any war would come in. At that time, the draft was 21 years old. It would be over by the time I'd be of age.
So what changed? How did you end up in the military?
Well, several things. They lowered the draft age to 20, and then they lowered it to 18. I became 18. I waved bye-bye to the family.
Was that hard for you?
Leaving El Paso, was very, very hard because my roots were here. I had never been too far away from El Paso, unless we went to visit my dad wherever he was working. It was an entirely new thing to me.
I bet it was hard on your mom.
My mom had passed away 4 days before my 16th birthday. So it was hard on my father because two of my brothers were already in the military and I was the third one. There were still two to follow, so there was five of us in the military at the same time, World War II.
Wow, that's a lot of prayers coming from El Paso for five boys overseas. How did you end up as a paratrooper?
Well, as a kid, where I lived, it was used to be the boondocks. Now it's even the center of town. But there was a plane that was in trouble, and in fact, it landed about a block from where we were, nose down, and we saw the pilot jumping out. And my brother and I went home and took one of my mother's best sheets, and we were jumping off the roof. And both of us became paratroopers.
How high was your roof?
Oh, I'd say about 10, 12 feet.
Did you hurt yourselves at all trying that?
No, not at all.
Well, don't try that at home if you're listening. So was becoming a paratrooper what you thought it would be? Was it exciting for you?
At the outset, it was a challenge, really. But my brother had already gone through the school. He went through the school about 3 months before I did. So I knew that I was going to make it. And at that time, supposedly, it was the toughest military training ever. And my mind was made up that I was going to make it.
Do you think it helped to have a brother going right before you?
Certainly did, yes.
But you guys probably didn't get to serve together in the same outfit, did you?
No, we did not. He served in the 513th, and I was 508.
Did you ever get to see him when you were overseas?
Not him. I saw another one of my brothers, saw him three times, once in England and twice in Germany.
That had to be really special to be so far away from El Paso, but have that little taste of home and that connection.
He wasn't expecting me because we weren't allowed to travel at that time in England. You had to have military travel. But the captain that was in charge of our company asked me if I could arrange it because I had told him that I found out where my brother was, and I said no. He took me with my Class A uniform to the train station with an armed guard, and he went and talked to the train master or something. And told him that I had to be at such and such a town, and the train master saw him. He was a captain, so he punched out my travel ticket, and I went to see my brother. My brother threw his whatever he was holding when he saw me, or not when he saw me. When he saw me, he didn't know who I was or didn't recognize me. He was surprised. And then he finally said, you know, my nickname. He said, "Eres tú, Helo," you know, in Spanish. Is that you? And yeah. He threw whatever it was, and yes, it was exciting.
So that was an uplifting moment, but the much more harrowing moments were still to come, like D-Day, what Angel did that day, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When you say the words hearing aid, people think of that big, bulky banana behind the ear, when the reality is today's modern hearing aid is completely unnoticeable.
That's Nathan Lev from locally owned Sound Advice with some news worth hearing.
We have access to all the major manufacturers, all the different styles. We carry a product called Lyric, which is a very new type of technology, and it suits a particular individual that is not able to wear a traditional type of hearing device. The Lyric product is the future of hearing devices.
Sound Advice offers its patients the best possible care and new innovative products. Call today to schedule a free hearing test and consultation. 579-1310.
We're not high pressure in any way. We're patient advocates, and we want to find each individual the best possible solution for their scenario.
Call Sound Advice today at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on D-Day today through the eyes of paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines 70 years ago. Back to the story of El Paso's Angel Romero, who served with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
We had been trained very, very thoroughly we had been trained technically and physically and mentally, and a lot of emphasis was placed on the mental part. Our day to D-Day started on the 5th of June, and I remember we got up real early and rolling and unrolling the bundles. They were checking to make sure that we weren't overloaded, which we were. Everybody was carrying more than we were supposed to. But in the area where I was, there was an aura of excitement. Finally, you know, let's get it over with. All they needed to do was to get us over there and we'd get it over with. That was our mentality at the time.
And before I forget, I want to hit on something else. You mentioned that in your school here in El Paso that you had felt the sting of discrimination. But I get the sense that in the 82nd Airborne, nobody saw skin color and they treated you the same as anybody else. Is that true?
Well, I felt a little special, actually, when I finally joined the 508, because I was a replacement. I was not with the original 508. I was a replacement before Normandy. When we arrived at the 508, I must have been around 2 o'clock in the morning, so they just assigned us wherever there was an empty cot. That's where I went, wherever they told me. And before I got assigned, or when I was supposed to be assigned, the guys in my squad where I was went to the colonel and asked him if they could keep me in their squad. So that made me feel kind of special. And even today, I still feel special with those guys. And after being in the airborne, I found out that they didn't give a good doodly whether you were whatever. All they expected you to do was to do your job and to do it well.
And you probably wouldn't survive if you didn't. So you said that there was this sense of excitement building, that you guys were ready to get it over with. So where did you jump, and how did that unfold for you?
We were supposed to have jumped in a little town called Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. We were supposed to capture a bridge there. I wound up landing in a little town called Saint Martin. We call it Saint Martin. They call it San Martin. It's got another name on it, but it was real close to the beach. It would be about 10 to 12 miles from where we were supposed to land.
So what went wrong? Pilot error or disorientation or what?
All of the ones that you mentioned, everything went wrong, and actually everything went right. If we had landed where we were supposed to have landed, they would have annihilated us within 2 days. And as it was, we were confused. But the Germans were more confused because they had no idea how many had jumped. They reported at least 10 airborne divisions had jumped. It was to our advantage that was such a big mix-up.
The confusion worked in your favor. So what kind of conditions did you face, and when did you encounter the enemy?
Very soon after landing, like I said, we were very close to the beach, so just about as soon as we landed, there were some firefights, and there was a lot of running going back and forth. And maybe about 10, 12 minutes after we landed, there were 3 plane loads from the 101st that landed, almost on top of us. So nobody knew where to go, and there was a labor camp close to where we were, and I could understand some words that were being said in the labor camp. So I started talking in Spanish, and it was very, very difficult. Years later on, I found out that they spoke Catalan, but some words were in Spanish, and I asked them where St. Mary Iglesia was, and one of them said, you know, way in the back, said, La Iglesia Santa Maria, you know, in Spanish. So I said, yes, and then somebody opened the gate there, and we started talking with them. As much as I could understand, it was very difficult. I couldn't understand much. And they told us which way to St. Mary Iglesias. I've never been to St. Mary Iglesias, and I've never been to Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. Never made it.
Sometimes God's plans are a little bit different than the way we or the military envision things working out. Were you scared? Did you feel the ever-present danger around you?
Not before. Like I said, we were trained mentally. And even after landing, I wasn't scared. The first time that I felt any type of fear was whether I could keep up with my comrades or not. That was my biggest fear then. And then, of course, encountering the snipers. They'd fire one shot, and we didn't know where it was coming from. And then it soaked in that you see your first buddy get shot or wounded, and you understand what it's all about. And then you realize that you're in something very, very different.
When was the first time that you were hit?
When it was the first time that I was wounded? It was on the 14th of June in a little town called Etienneville, right at the end of the hedgerows. And I was shot in the leg. We were hedge hopping each other. We were actually running from the Germans, and there was 8 of us. And one would run, and the other 7 would fire, and so on, until we got away from them. I don't remember being shot because, like I said, we were running. I remember falling backwards and running. Quite a while later, we were in that little town, in a little church. We sat down, and one of the guys took off all of his equipment, started playing Boogie Woogie and a piano there. And the guy next to me said, "What happened to your leg?" I said, "Nothing." "Why?" He said, "Look at it." And that's when it hurt. Yeah. But I hadn't felt anything until then.
You think it was just the degree of mental intensity required to do what you were doing that kept you from feeling that pain?
Probably in part, and probably the excitement that was going on, the fear of getting shot, that we were outnumbered and we were outrunning them. No time to think about anything except survival, I guess. That's part of it.
June 6th is rolling around again, and I'm sure every year it makes you think about a lot of things, but in your mind, what is the significance of June 6th, and what makes you proud to have been a part of it?
My buddies. Meeting some of my buddies. Knowing now what I know about them and what they know about me. Just last October, I saw one of them. There's 2 of us left in the squad that I was in. Still, the respect and the love keeps growing.
And what strikes me about all you guys that I've talked to here is Normandy itself would be enough for anyone to survive and endure and deal with everything you went through there. But the war kept going, and you had these other operations that were just as intense, if not worse. What was the most difficult situation you faced? What was the time that you think was most trying for you throughout the war?
I couldn't pick out one. The weather-wise, nothing could equal the Battle of the Bulge. But Normandy was one, like you said, the insecurity, uncertainty of what was going on. In Holland, we got to fight the Germans' best. We got to fight against the Fallschirmjäger. And, of course, the Battle of the Bulge, we encountered quite a bit because we were so outnumbered. And then, like I said, the weather, we weren't equipped for that type of a situation. Our battalion was the ones that stopped the attack going north, so that was pretty bad. Just in our area, in our company area where we stopped them, there were 122 dead SS troops in the company area. And so that might give you an idea of what the intensity of the fight.
Intensity sounds like the right word. And when you say wounded the first time, it indicates there were more, including Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands in September 44.
I was wounded in Holland by a couple of grenades. And then in the Battle of the Bulge, I was wounded in an attack. And when we started the counterattack, the 3rd Battalion of the 508th was leading the counterattack for the 82nd. And I was wounded on the 7th of January.
What happened?
On that one, I was wounded by artillery. I was hit by artillery in the back.
Were you evacuated immediately, or did you have to wait around in the snow to be rescued?
I don't know how long I was. I was knocked out by what happened. I remember the next thing I remember was a guy from I Company was telling me to start moving or I'd freeze. And another guy was there. A couple of medics on a Trek Jeep came by and put us in the Jeep. They were frozen worse than we were, but they carried us back. And put us in a little cabin. There was a fire there. That was what they, to the medics, the most important thing was to get us to somewhere where it was warm, because at that, in that type of cold, you would freeze in a few minutes.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, and I'm guessing that that moment when you come to and you're trying to figure out what happened to you, that's got to be pretty intimidating and pretty scary. What was that like for you?
Actually, you're in a daze. You have absolutely no idea what, or I didn't have any idea what was going on. The first thing that that struck me was that I knew the guy that was talking to me from my company. He kept telling me, you better move or you're going to freeze. And it took, I don't know how long it took to realize that something had happened to me. I didn't know at the time what had happened to me. But we did start moving because of him.
And did that end the war for you, or were you able to continue fighting?
No, I was taken out to a field hospital. They had set up a field hospital. I think it was a school. They did some tests on me because I couldn't breathe, where the shrapnel didn't penetrate. It just created a big, couple of big lumps in my back, and just a very, very small aperture in the skin. They told me that I would be all right, and I was there, and some nut came by and said that they had stolen a couple of trucks and were going back. They said, just don't get up and go right now because they're watching you. But wait a couple of minutes and the trucks are parked in such and such a place. So I went day well from the hospital and went back to the lines.
So you snuck out of the hospital to get back with your buddies?
Yes. I stayed on until the 508 was relieved at the Roy River. We were relieved in March. We were sent back to an airfield in Drew, France. And the 508 was prepared to jump in case of atrocities. That's where I was when the war ended.
Now, I read an article about you at some point, and I think I saw something that the 23rd Psalm had been of significance to you. What was the story there?
Most of the time, I was a first scout in the company. So being out there, I wore the 23rd Psalm out. You don't hear it too often because I wore it out. I prayed all the time.
Because if you're the first scout, you don't know what's out there. There's going to be enemy around somewhere, and you're about as vulnerable as a soldier can possibly be? Is that what you're saying?
No, not really, because as it turned out, I was probably the safest guy in the company. The Germans would allow one or two guys to penetrate, and then they would fire on the main group. My job was that they wouldn't, and according to my buddies, I was very successful. I could detect just about anything. I can't explain what it was, but I could sense a lot of things.
But you certainly felt like you were walking through the valley of the shadow of death at that point, I guess.
Yes, certainly.
When you look back on it all now, when you get together with all these guys, when you think back about everything you went through, the wounds that you suffered that could have ended your life that didn't, what are you most thankful for?
Probably my life first, of course, and the people I served with. There's no other group. There's nobody else in this world like them.
And just visiting with you guys here and knowing that all of you were wounded multiple times, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of veterans. A lot of them were wounded, but most of them, they're wounded once, maybe twice. But a lot of you guys wounded three more times. It seems like you guys understand each other more than the rest of us could understand. Is that a sense you get, that being around these guys, they really know what it was like to walk in your shoes?
Yes, especially in the airborne, because we mentioned the divisions, we mentioned the units, we mentioned everything. But really, when you mention airborne, that's the one word.
Even if it's the Screaming Eagles against AA, huh? Tell me about the rivalry that exists here between the 101st and the 82nd.
Well, the stories go that the 82nd, of course, was the first one to be airborne. And then some of the cadre from the 82nd went to the 101st. So it's always been some of the men in the 101st were 82nd before they were 101st. And there was always that competition. The 82nd, before I joined the 82nd, had already gone into North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. So the pride goes back to a lot of accomplishments, and the rivalry is always who did what, who did when, who, and in reality, we depended on each other.
Absolutely, but you still like to tease each other. So what? How do you tease them about the Screaming Eagles? What is it that you say to the 101st guys?
What were you screaming for when you were in Bastogne? And it was, help!
And what do they say back to you?
The double A means almost airborne. It's always, this is always going on.
Well, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you want to share, that you want people to know about you and the guys like you who did what you did all those years ago?
I think that the most important thing is that at the time, we were equal. There was no discrimination. When you're suspended by parachute, nobody knows your ethnicity, your creed, your whatever. You're just another person suspended by parachute. I learned to respect every one of the men I served with, and in most cases, I learned to love them. I hope that today's generations look at our service members today and respect them. I respect them.
Those were the final fitting words I got from Angel Romero a few months before he left us in 2012. And as we reflect on 70 years since that day that changed the world, we've heard from two men who put their lives on the line then and again and again. And as Angel said, let's not forget about those men and women serving right now. We know they're willing to do just what our greatest generation did all those years ago. Let's just hope and pray they don't have to. That's our program for today. You can find more information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.